Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about polycystic ovary syndrome, otherwise known as PCOS. We're going to pretty much cover it soup to nuts, diagnosis, treatment, getting pregnant with it, living with it, you name it. An important topic, so many people in our community have been diagnosed with this disease. And whether or not they're actively trying to get pregnant, they're still dealing with it. This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a free program they want you to know about. It's called My Fertility Navigator. The program offers free one-on-one support for women who are struggling to get pregnant, and they're at the point where they really don't know what their next step should be. And the beauty of My Fertility Navigator is that a woman, when she enrolls, will receive personalized guidance from a real live human being, her fertility navigator. And this person can provide important information about fertility, including a list of nearby fertility centers, if that's the next step in her fertility journey. It would also provide information on financial resources and can discuss some of the many fertility treatments that might be available for her. You can get more information at myfertilitynav.com. And we thank Ferring for their support. In addition to Ferring, we have partners with clinics and agencies who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support, medically accurate for the patient community. Some of our wonderful sponsors and partners include Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are one of the largest fertility practices in the state of New York and one of the largest in the country. They combine the latest innovations in reproductive science with compassionate and customized treatment plans, and they are able to provide the best possible care because that is their mission, to combine those two. We also want to thank IntegraMed Fertility for their support and their partnership and that allows us to bring you this show. IntegraMed Fertility is one of the largest, or is the largest actually, network of fertility practices in the country. By combining the latest innovations in reproductive science with compassionate and customized treatment plans, they are able to provide the very best possible care through their network of clinics. And you can find out which clinics are a part of their network by going to their website. Today we're titling this show PCOS 101 because, as I said at the beginning, we're really wanting it to be comprehensive. From the, do I have PCOS? What is PCOS? And by the way, PCOS is polycystic ovary syndrome. And then how do I treat it? And what do I mean by treatment? Am I trying to get pregnant? Is that treatment? Am I concerned about the long-term health impacts of having this disease? And what impact does weight have? Is a chicken and egg thing? Is weight the cause of or caused by? Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Martinez, a reproductive endocrinologist at the Reproductive Science Center of New Jersey, about all things PCOS. This is a show first aired a couple of years ago, a topic that we continue to get questions on our online community, which, by the way, is a closed Facebook support group. Well, we have a lot of online communities, but one of which is a closed Facebook support group, which you can find at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily. And we continue to get questions on polycystic ovary syndrome. A lot of times the questions are about how to get pregnant, but they're also more general questions about how to lose weight. If you have PCOS, what's the best way to lose weight? Should you consider bariatric surgery? And what if you're one of the thin people who has PCOS? Anyway, because we continue to get questions, we wanted to bring this show to you because Dr. Martinez did such a great job of answering all of these questions, plus some you probably haven't even thought about. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome, Dr. Martinez, to Creating a Family.
Thank you, Dawn, for having me. I appreciate it.
So this is going to be a show. We got a lot of questions from our audience. As you might imagine, PCOS is a very popular topic. A lot of people in our community suffer with this syndrome. Let's start at the beginning. Good place to always begin, right? Let's start talking about the common symptoms that a woman might have of polycystic ovary syndrome. Let me mention that it's also, I don't ever hear it referred to this, but perhaps in medical circles it still is being referred to as Stein-Leventhal syndrome. But in case somebody has heard of Stein-Leventhal syndrome, that is the same thing as polycystic ovary syndrome. So what are some of the common symptoms that we see?
So with patients with polycystic ovary syndrome, they most commonly present with either irregular menstrual periods or amenorrhea, which is no menstrual periods altogether. That's one of the main presenting symptoms. And also they can have signs of elevated male hormones in their body, are called androgens, hyperandrogenism, which is clinical evidence of hyperandrogenism, which can be things such as adult acne. It can be abnormal hair growth, so of a male pattern nature. So it could be on the chin, chest, abdomen, where women are having to pluck hairs and address those issues. And then the other thing is that it can also be responsible for such things as insulin resistance, and that's a component that we can talk about throughout the show that can predispose people to, you know, having higher instances of diabetes and such as also cardiovascular disease later on in life.
Yeah, okay, we are going to come back because one of the things we do, although we are really focused as an organization on infertility. Infertility is just one of the symptoms. And
correct,
it does have other significant health consequences. Okay, so we will talk about that. We got a question from Megan. She asked, can you have PCOS and have regular periods? I have many of the other PCOS signs and symptoms except for irregular periods.
Yes, you actually can, and it's a common question that we get with our patients. The most common ways that PCOS is diagnosed, there's a few different criteria that are used. There's one that came out of the National Institutes of Health, the NICHD, back in 1990, and then there's another commonly used, the Rotterdam criteria. And I think that these are the two major criteria that are used. But the answer is that you can have regular periods. You just may not be always releasing an egg, so you may have an anovulatory cycle. And so it's not necessary to have a period or to have irregular periods per se.
But if you're having regular periods, aren't you likely ovulating? I mean, if you were truly anovulatory, if the periods were totally anovulatory, if I'm saying that correctly, wouldn't you be more likely to be irregular and skip? I mean, is it possible to be totally in every time not ovulating but be very regular?
No, in most cases, I believe that it is more of an oligo ovulation, which means that it doesn't happen every time, but it's sporadic, and so many women come to our clinic for evaluation for infertility because they've been trying to conceive, and even though their periods may be within the regular range, right around give or take 28 days, you know, between their menstrual periods, they can still not ovulate all the time, and that can put them at risk for infertility.
Okay. And we got a number of questions asking about what causes this polycystic ovary syndrome. What do we know what causes this?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know the exact cause of PCOS. We know that PCOS in and of itself is a clinical manifestation of changes in the normal hormones that result in kind of the ovarian monthly cycle, and meaning that the brain talks to the ovaries, it sends signals, the ovary has to respond in a very predetermined way, and if that gets altered at all for whatever particular reason, that's enough to create polycystic ovaries and the symptoms that go along with it. We do know that it has a genetic component. It does aggregate and run in families. And it may also have an environmental cause as well, which we haven't elucidated, but that is a possibility.
I wanted to talk to you some about the environmental causes. But before I get to that, what is PCOS more common now than in the past?
That's a very good question. And I believe that women health providers, the general obstetrician gynecologist, as well as the general public in the infertility world, are more aware of polycystic ovary syndrome. Now, with that being said, we know that there's a direct correlation with one of the phenotypes of PCOS is associated with obesity. So having an elevated body weight, that can change the dynamics of the hormones that I mentioned before, and it can actually predispose people to becoming anovulatory and developing PCOS. So I think that in general, the population is becoming, you know, there's a larger proportion of people that are overweight, and I think that that's changed over the years, and that might predispose people to more likely to develop PCOS.
But then that's kind of the chicken and egg thing. Does PCOS cause people to be overweight, or is PCOS caused by people being overweight?
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good point. Definitely, PCOS has an association with obesity, but there's also a lean phenotype. So about 35 to 60% of people will be obese and have PCOS, but there's also a lean phenotype. So we know that obesity in and of itself can create insulin resistance and change the way that our body deals with sugar loads. And that is part of the pathophysiology and the reason, one of the major causes of why people become anovulatory. They don't release an egg every month. They have irregular cycles and present with a PCOS phenotype.
Okay. Then let's talk about other environmental factors. The prevalence of our eating patterns, it sounds like, with some people, might make them more likely to develop PCOS, if I understood you correctly. So that is an environmental factor. Are there other environmental factors? And I'm thinking in terms of things like chemical exposures, or, you know, the host of, we kind of swim in a lot of chemicals that we didn't use to. I don't mean literally swimming, I mean living in chemicals.
Yes.
that didn't used to be present. Has there been any research on the chemical exposures, toxins and environmental toxins, could reflect in an increase in PCOS?
There has been some preliminary research with you know, a couple of different environmental toxins. I know that some groups have looked at bisphenol A or BPA, which is the plasticizer. Remember, they removed all the BPA from, like, infant
right.
bottles and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there are environmental agents, so BPA, such as BPA, that are estrogen-like. And increases in estrogen in the body, seeing more estrogen, plays a role in changing the dynamics of how the ovary functions on a monthly cycle. And so these things can and may have a role in it. The research is preliminary, but there is some evidence, definitely from estrogen type components, that it may contribute to this in some way.
And I will link to in the blog tomorrow. We've done shows on this topic a number of shows, including one, and I'm blanking on her name, and I shouldn't be, one of the lead researchers out of Stanford who has been doing a lot of research. She presented at ASRM 2 years ago. Anyway, I will I'll link to that in the blog tomorrow. All right, here's a question from Cindy. She wants to know, why aren't doctors more knowledgeable? She said, I've had all the symptoms and but was never told that my illness had a name or that so many others had the same problem. Do you see this as an issue when people come to you that as a reproductive endocrinologist that you're the first one who has identified and given a name to what they have? Or is that just Cindy's unique experience with her one doctor?
No, I actually think that's not unique. I have patients that present to the office and they have a history of irregular cycles, you know, or just prolonged cycles. And, you know, when we get into their history, we find out that they have some of these symptoms and they kind of fit into that classic presentation of PCOS. And I think that a lot of the general OBGYNs and the other medical communities like family medicine, internal medicine, that there's still a need for more of an education and awareness of this condition. And so, Cindy, you're not alone in this. You know, it's very common. I see people in the office, and yes, they fit the classic presentation. They go over their history. We do an ultrasound, and we find very characteristic, very characteristic appearance of the ovaries, and they're diagnosed with that. So it is not uncommon.
Now here's a question from Angie. She wants to know if fatigue is a common symptom. She says it's so hard. Fatigue is so hard. When you mention fatigue and infertility to a doctor, they instantly want to diagnose you with depression. You didn't mention fatigue as one of the common symptoms. Is that a symptom, if common or uncommon?
Fatigue in and of itself is not a symptom of PCOS. And, you know, it is difficult. She is right that PCOS and the condition itself can present in many different ways. And, but fatigue is not a common entity of it. And I think that it behooves your physician or whoever the provider you're dealing with to investigate that more to make sure, okay, how is the patient presenting? What else is going on? It can be from changes in physiology of the body. It can be from external environmental influences. But definitely fatigue in and of itself is not a common, you know, entity of this disease.
Okay, so for Angie, she may need to be looking for she may be assuming that her fatigue is associated with PCOS because that is a condition she has, but she may need to be looking for other causes, it sounds like.
Correct. And I think it depends upon, you know, the rest of her medical history, you know, her physician. We can also evaluate other things, other endocrine issues that are more commonly associated with fatigue. And I think that's where you start and you consider everything as a whole.
Is PCOS more, if you have PCOS, are you more likely to have other endocrine type issues as well, a dysfunctioning endocrine system?
PCOS has a strong association with insulin resistance. And it's actually recommended that women who are diagnosed with PCOS, they undergo glucose testing to see if they're either pre-diabetic or diabetic. So that's one of the most common things that is associated with PCOS.
And that's an endocrine...
Correct.
That's an endocrine disease.
Correct, yes.
Okay, gotcha. Any other endocrine diseases that women with PCOS need to think that they are at increased risk for?
No, diabetes is and changes in the way the body handles glucose and sugar is the primary one.
Okay. All right, we have this from Shelley. She says, I hate the weight issues the most because people tell me I'm a liar when I say I follow a diet and still can't lose weight. I'd like to lose weight and be healthier, but the scale won't budge. And when it does, it's a pound a month, and to be perfectly honest, that's not worth the epic struggle. I work three times as hard to lose weight to have a quarter of the results. I hear this a lot from people with PCOS who have the phenotype that is the obese or overweight type, that it is not just that they gain weight, but that losing weight is just an epic struggle. And no matter what they do, they don't seem to lose weight. Is this something that is common with the disease of PCOS?
And unfortunately, we do find that in our PCOS patients, that they have a more difficult time losing weight and keeping off weight. And it is a constant struggle, and it's something that we try to address with them through various avenues. And I'd be happy to talk with those if you would like.
Yeah, because one of the questions I have is there any type of diet or eating style that is more effective with PCOS for losing weight than others?
And it's a very good question. I think that there will be proponents of different diets, you know, and our patients, you know, especially patients with PCOS, may actually, you know, find groups that are promoting one diet over another diet. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of evidence behind specific diets. What it comes down to is, and this is with many things, it's just eating healthy. It's having a balanced, you know, fat, protein, carbohydrate intake. If you eat carbohydrates, you should take complex carbohydrates, because, you know, whole grains, fruits, vegetables, those kinds of things, your body will handle that better, and that is the avenue that we promote. It's just an overall healthy diet. Specific carb restrictions or Atkins diets, protein-style diets, they haven't overall shown to be any better than just an overall, you know, healthy diet on a daily basis. And I think that it's important with the patients is that the goal is not to lose large amounts of weight quickly, because the likelihood of keeping the weight off is decreased if a patient does that. So, you know, a pound a week, while it may not seem like a lot, if it becomes a lifestyle change and the patient is eating healthier, not only PCOS, but other things such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, you can decrease the chances of the patient, you know, of getting this later on. And so I think that it's slow moderation. It's a lifestyle change. It's not just, I don't like the word diet. I like just eating healthy. I don't want to put a negative connotation on it. And then it's the amount of physical activity. So again, I don't like to say the word exercise, but if a person is more active on a daily basis, you're going to be more likely to burn more calories. And then if you're watching what you're eating and you're eating healthy, you're eating the right things, and that's going to put you on the path to losing some weight. And that is really the approach that I choose. I also want to say that when you talk about losing weight, really in PCOS, when we're talking about the world of infertility and treatments for patients with PCOS, as little as a 2-5% weight loss can kind of recharge the system and redirect the hormone levels and cause women to start ovulating. So that can even be beneficial. So it's not huge amounts of weight necessarily, but it's a lifestyle change, and it's a slow, steady progression for a long-term goal.
Is bariatric surgery, weight loss surgery, effective at lowering the weight of PCOS sufferers, for one, and then does it improve their symptoms and overall health and their fertility if they lose their weight through surgery?
So the answer is yes, it can be helpful. As mentioned previously, the 2-5% weight loss is sometimes enough to, you know, to help out the infertility aspects and to increase the chances of a woman ovulating. You know, the bariatric surgery is reserved for people that have, a more elevated weight, and they have a larger weight loss to achieve. So it can definitely change the metabolic profile of a patient. It can help out with their diabetes. It can help out with their PCOS. help out with the way their body handles sugar. And so there's definitely a role, but it's on an individualized basis, and it would be up to, you know, the after careful evaluation and then being a candidate for bariatric surgery, patients have to go through a series of tests and make sure that they're candidates for that. But it can be very helpful.
And the question there is, and there has been, actually some of the research results are inconclusive as to whether or not surgery is successful in keeping weight off in the long term. What have you read recently? I haven't really been keeping up with that on the more current, but at one point there was concern that although there was weight loss, people tended to gain it back after bariatric surgery. Has that finding held up through research?
Well, you know, my knowledge of this is not very vast, but I do know that there's different types of bariatric surgeries, and with those surgeries, there's risks of people slowly eating more and being able to eat more and having a harder time, you know, keeping off the weight. But again, it becomes an issue of the mind of the body and really working towards a common goal and remembering why the patient had the surgery in the first place and then having that long-term goal of keeping off the weight. So it becomes, again, it always goes back to the lifestyle changes and the motivation and the mental fortitude of the patient.
You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about living with polycystic ovary syndrome. Creating a Family has the largest infertility and adoption communities on the social networks, and we would love to have you join us. Actually, Clout is now ranking us as number two online influencer worldwide in the areas of adoption as well as infertility. There are three ways to connect with us on Facebook. You can, of course, connect with us on our page, which is facebook.com/creatingafamily. You can connect with our group, which is a very large, very active, and very supportive online support group, and that is facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily. Or you could, for finding either of those, you can just type the words Creating a Family in the Facebook search box, and both the page and the group will pop up, and you can like the page and join the group. Or you can connect with me personally, dawn.davenport1. We also hang out a lot on both Twitter and Pinterest, and on both of those, you can find us at Creating a Family. We have a question from Leslie. She wants to know if there's any evidence that avoiding gluten will improve the symptoms of PCOS.
That's a very interesting question. The gluten in and of itself, from my understanding, does not have a strong correlation with improving PCOS. I think that there's definitely ongoing research on this, but as far as I know, there's not a strong correlation with that at this point.
Okay. Now I want to move. You talked briefly about diagnosis, and the one question I do want to ask is, clearly when you go to an endocrinologist, a reproductive endocrinologist or other endocrinologist, you can receive a diagnosis there. If you are having some of the symptoms you mentioned, however, is it possible, do you need to go to an endocrinologist, or can you be diagnosed and, more importantly, treated? And we're going to go into treatment options here in just a minute. Can you be treated effectively by your regular gynecologist, or should you seek out an endocrinologist of some sort? And in this case, it might make sense to go to a reproductive endocrinologist.
Well, I think it depends upon the presenting symptoms of the individual. So if the patient is seeing their general physician and they have infertility, you know, concerns, then there are, you know, some obstetrician gynecologists that will feel comfortable with diagnosing and then preliminarily treating PCOS patients. And there's the other spectrum of it where patients are referred to our office because of the suspicion for PCOS, and their medical providers just deem that we're better suited for that. It certainly is not a necessity as far as diagnosing PCOS, because the criteria are fairly straightforward. However, when it comes to addressing issues related to PCOS, I think that's where individual providers, it depends upon what the patient is seeking and what the patient needs.
If a patient is not actively trying to get pregnant, does it still make sense to go to a reproductive endocrinologist for the treatment of PCOS? Or should that be should that be wait until they're actively trying to get pregnant?
I guess it's on an individualized basis. We do have patients that are not seeking fertility, but they may have very irregular periods. They may have issues with irregular bleeding, you know, outside of their normal menstrual cycles, and they come to our office, and we can very well evaluate them, and we're very capable of doing that. I think it's on an individualized basis, but there's nothing wrong with seeing a reproductive endocrinologist initially, and then for an evaluation, and then depending on what the patient needs after that, whether they need to, they can go back to their OBGYN or whether they would need to continue in our office for fertility in the future.
Yeah, and one of the things that unfortunately patients have to be cognizant of is whether or not their insurance will cover it. Once they're at a infertility clinic, the insurance could be making assumptions that they don't cover infertility and so are infertility treatments. So that's something that patients will have to think through, perhaps with the help of almost all infertility clinics. Reproductive endocrinologist offices will have somebody on staff who can help you figure out whether your insurance, and it may just be an issue of making certain that it's coded correctly, that it's treatment
correct
for the PCOS,
yes,
not
yes
for fertility. Mm-hmm.
Yes. May, do you mind if I comment a little bit
no,
on that?
No, I'd love for you to.
Okay. Yes, I commonly get this question. We get in our office, you know, quite often. What ends up happening is a lot of the patients that do come to us, you know, so we talked about the irregular periods, we talked about the lack of periods in some patients. You know, we talked about the irregular bleeding a little bit. I alluded to that. They talked about some of the metabolic things, the obesity and associations with diabetes. Oftentimes when you know patients come to our office, they will have these complaints, and it won't a large segment of the time it's not just infertility. So in those cases, you know, they are seen for a medical indication that their insurance is oftentimes for the initial workup or the initial visits and the tests that go with PCOS, those will oftentimes be covered. When the patient then, and if they need any further infertility treatments or any infertility treatments, then at that point it usually goes into the infertility diagnosis category, and then it varies a lot of, depending on what state you're in, what insurance you have, but you are correct. We do have patient care representatives, and this is very common throughout the reproductive endocrinology offices that help the patients navigate that. So you're not going to feel like you're alone, and you're going to know going in, you know, what benefits you have and then the best way to proceed. So there's people here to help for that.
Exactly. And quite frankly, mm-hmm, oftentimes you need, you know, even very smart people need help because insurance is a maze at times, and it helps if you've walked that maze or live in that maze, which usually there's somebody at the clinic who does.
Correct. Now, with that being said, it is still a maze. It remains a maze, and even the people that do it full-time in our field, it's constantly changing, and we really try to help, you know, guide the patients through the process. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now let's move over to talking about treatment for PCOS. And we got questions that kind of surprised me a lot about asking about specific drug names, but I'm going to come to that in a minute. Women are often told to take birth control pills to control the symptoms. So the first question is, does it matter what type of birth control pill that they should take, or is the pill the pill?
Yes, and we often get this question too. So the answer is, in the majority of cases, the patient benefits best from a a combined estrogen and progestin pill. And so, not to mention any specific kinds, but this is one of the combined oral contraceptive pill is the one of the most common prescribed medications, and this can be for regulating cycles. This can be for painful periods, and so the answer is, in short, is that a combined estrogen and progestin pill, having both components, will do the best job with addressing some of the PCOS related symptoms, specifically talking about irregular periods and regulating kind of the menstrual cycles.
And what about the hair growth, that aspect and the weight gain? Are those symptoms aided by the combined oral contraceptive pill?
Yes, the combined oral contraceptive pill makes or increases the what's something called the sex hormone binding globulin, and that will actually take up any of the proportions of the male hormone testosterone that floats around in the patient's blood. And by taking oral contraceptives, it increases the sex hormone binding globulin, so there's less free testosterone. Free testosterone in the body is what is actually responsible for the increased hair growth and some of the androgenic, the acne symptoms and those kind of things. So patients can derive a benefit from that by just taking the oral contraceptives.
Okay, well, this begs Stephanie's question, and she says, how can I manage my symptoms and still get pregnant? I was told that the pill is the best way to control PCOS, but I'm trying to get pregnant, which a lot of the women in our community would fit that bill, where they are that infertility is one of the symptoms they want to control, and obviously the birth control pill is not very effective at improving that symptom. In fact, one might argue that it was the direct opposite of that.
You are correct with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right,
so.
Yeah. So what do you do if you have PCOS and you want to get pregnant?
So the main cause and the main reason why people have a difficult time conceiving and getting pregnant with PCOS is that they have menstrual cycles or periods of time where they don't normally ovulate or release an egg from the ovary. So egg and sperm have to meet in order for you to get pregnant. So then when we're talking kind of two different things, basically. If you want to attempt to treat the symptoms of PCOS, we're talking about the acne, we're talking about the hair growth, but yet a patient wants to conceive, oftentimes a decision has to be made about which one is the preferred target. So they are mutually exclusive because a lot of medications and the medications that are needed to get rid of the hair growth, they are directly damaging to a growing pregnancy. So we're recommended to be on birth control pills. If a patient is taking birth control pills, obviously they're not going to get pregnant. So it's an individualized basis where the patient comes to us. And if the issue is hair growth, you know, then we can talk about, okay, you know, we can't medically treat you for that necessarily, but we can consider, you know, just doing kind of topical things with like the shaving, plucking, waxing, just encouraging that to deal with that particular symptom. For as far as getting patients to release an egg or ovulate, there are medications that we can give that counteract any potential problems of the ovary. And in most of the PCOS patients, we can get the ovaries to grow eggs, and we can, through interventions, we can follow the growth of those eggs. We can trigger the release of an egg, and then we can attempt to get people pregnant. It's on an individualized basis, but that's kind of the first treatment starting point.
Okay, and just in general, how effective is, what are the odds that a woman with PCOS will be able to get pregnant with treatment?
Well, it's actually pretty good with PCOS. So the major issue is that for many of the PCOS patients, they just don't release the egg. So by tricking the body into sending more of a signal to the ovaries to develop an egg at the beginning of a normal menstrual cycle, that increases the chances tremendously. And you can actually be very successful with PCOS patients with actually getting them pregnant and allowing them to start their families.
Are the oral fertility meds, such as letrozole, Clomid, and I imagine there are others, are they effective? I mean, those are ovulatory stimulating drugs, as I understand it. So are they effective for people with PCOS to stimulate their ovaries to ovulate?
The answer is it all depends upon the results of the fertility workup for the individual. So when a patient comes to our office, they will undergo testing of the ovaries to see how well the ovaries are functioning for the patient's age. And I like to say, are your ovaries behaving? We're trying to figure out if your ovaries are behaving your age, they're acting older than you or younger than you. And so we do a series of tests, sometimes at the beginning of a menstrual cycle, sometimes at any point in the menstrual cycle, to kind of gauge and evaluate how well the ovaries are working. If the ovaries are functioning at a fairly good level, and then the oral agents, such as the clomiphene citrate, the letrozole, these are two common medications, those are definite considerations in recruiting an egg and increasing the chances of a patient getting pregnant.
All right. So the key, as you've mentioned, is for what we want is the other symptoms women can treat other ways, and if they're safe, or just put up with for the duration of their trying to conceive time. So the main focus for people who are trying to conceive and are not being able to conceive because they're not ovulating because of PCOS. So the main goal then is to get them to ovulate. What are some
Correct.
Of the drug treatments of choice? We've just talked about two, clomiphene citrate and otherwise known as Clomid, or letrozole. What is the brand name for letrozole? I just blanked on it.
It is called Femara.
Femara.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So those could be that they are those. It is possible that they will jumpstart your ovulation. What are some other drugs that are used to try to get people to ovulate with PCOS?
Well, I want to just back up a little bit before I go into more of the medications, and I just wanted to reiterate that the first line treatment in women that are not releasing an egg or they're anovulatory that have PCOS, it still remains weight loss. Okay?
Gotcha.
And so we've already, now we're talking past that point, but that just deserves consideration because that can be enough to not need any medications. And it can even help out in patients who are taking medications. So the body will respond better.
And just to reiterate, it doesn't have to be even getting you within the normal weight, even getting you out of obesity. A 2 to 5% is from what you were saying might be enough to let your body start ovulating again.
Correct, and that's always a very important point because I think a lot of patients want to, you know, who are overweight may want to see themselves lose 30 or 40 pounds. Well, you know, that is a great goal, but, you know, I like to prefer more baby steps, you know, and helping the patients kind of get, you know, start to develop that a lifestyle, some changes in their diet, in their activity level, that leads to slow changes and it becomes a part of who they are. That's the goal, and that's the long-standing thing that is going to help them the rest of their life, you know. And so that is definitely the approach. Not a huge amounts of weight. You start with small, and if you do well, then you could continue on that trend.
Okay. So let's assume that they either have lost weight or in the process of trying to lose some weight. And one of the frustrating things, of course, is that time is not on anybody's side when we talk about fertility, and so they may choose not to wait until the weight loss is there, or they've lost some weight and it has not been enough, or they're one of the people who, not everyone who has PCOS is overweight. So,
correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the next line of attack if weight loss has either just begun and is not far enough along, mm-hmm. or they have lost the weight and are still not ovulating?
Yeah. So one of the other medications that, you know, I'm sure that some of the patients have questions on, or you guys have talked about on the radio show before, is potentially a medication called metformin.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a medication that is often prescribed to patients with PCOS. And the idea is that if a patient who has PCOS also has some insulin resistance, metformin is an insulin sensitizer, so the body handles sugar loads better, and that is thought to relate directly, carry back to the function of the ovary and releasing an egg. So there are schools of thought, and there's indication in patients that definitely have insulin resistance. They've been tested for that. They may be pre-diabetic. They can benefit by administration of metformin, which is an oral pill, and that is sometimes helpful with getting patients to ovulate. And it's also used with both the oral medications, the Clomid and the Letrozole, and as well as in the next step of medications, which we consider for fertility treatments, are injectable medications to get the ovaries to grow eggs. I just want to mention that there are a couple schools of thought on metformin, and the research vacillates between, you know, who should be on metformin. But it appears that the patients that benefit the most from it are the patients that have documented through prior testing some insulin resistance, and they have a pre-diabetic disposition. There's another school of thought that says all patients should be on metformin if they have PCOS. And I think that, you know, the research will continue on this, and hopefully we'll have a more solidified answer. But even within the field of reproductive endocrinology, there's differing opinions on who should be on metformin. But definitely in the patient who has insulin resistance, it can help out.
Okay, some other meds we've got questions. We've received questions on, and I'll probably slaughter the pronunciation. Let's see. I've practiced on this one. Spironolactone. Brand
mm-hmm.
name is
yes.
Aldactone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what that is. I've not actually heard of that before, and we had two people to ask about it. So what is spironolactone?
Spironolactone is a medication that is indicated for the treatment of the abnormal hair growth symptoms.
Okay.
So it is addressing not the infertility aspects and the ovulation, but it's addressing the physical manifestations of PCOS.
Gotcha.
And so it is commonly used, and it's one of the first line treatments for people that have, you know, excessive hair growth, or it's also called hirsutism is the medical term for that. So patients that have tried to pluck wax, whatever they've had to do in the past, often the patients, they still don't get a benefit from that, or they're tired of doing that. They want to try other things. And then, so spironolactone is kind of the next step. It's for addressing the hair growth. The difficulty is that contraindicated to be pregnant on that medication, because it can directly affect the female fetus. And so, you know, patients who are asking about that, they're thinking more of the lifestyle, you know, concerns with PCOS, and if and when they're going to be ready to, you know, seek infertility treatments or need it in the future, then the recommendation would be to stop that medication at that time.
Gotcha, yes. It's similar to Accutane, which is often used to treat acne.
Really bad acne, yes. I also just wanted to mention briefly about the spironolactone. I think it's an important point, is that when your physician puts you on spironolactone, really the indication is to be on it for a minimum of 6 months, because that's the ideal time frame of when you should really start to see a benefit. So patients that might be placed on it and not be happy with it during the first 1, 2, or 3 months, really the recommendation is to stick with it and then evaluate at a six-month interval from there.
Some in our audience talked about some really significant side effects from the spironolactone. Does it have a particularly bad side effect profile, or was that the people who were talking, or it was actually just one person, was she particularly sensitive to it?
And did she specifically mention what she was
mood changes and suicidal thoughts.
Okay. They definitely spironolactone is not a medication that we take lightly as medical providers. I mean, it has the common things of, you know, nausea, some GI changes, maybe, you know, diarrhea, headaches, and those kind of things. In more severe cases, it can change some your potassium levels in the body. It can change some of the blood levels, and it can also affect the liver function and the kidneys. So it is a medication that usually when your doctor prescribes this, what they're going to do is they're going to do some baseline blood work on you to make sure that you're a candidate for it, and then they may follow you from there. It is, you know, in and of itself, it's not a medication with minimal amounts of side effects. So I think that it definitely warrants an individualized discussion with your medical provider, as well as the other medications that you're on before going on spironolactone.
And that's, and just from a layperson standpoint, that's a hard one, because it's being used to treat, which I'm not in any way saying that hair growth is not a significant, it is a significant issue. And if you've got hair growth, especially if it's on your face and it's easily seen, it's a big deal. But it is a cosmetic thing. And so when you're thinking of taking a medication that is systemic to treat something that's cosmetic, that's a hard decision to make. So definitely needs to be made with some care, it sounds like, as well.
Correct. And in some patients, you know, they may have tried the other avenues and you know, like plucking, shaving, waxing, those kind of things. And really at the end of the day, it's a temporary thing. They may want something, you know, that addresses more of the hair growth from the origin. But it needs to be done in care with your medical provider on an individualized basis. Yes.
Yeah, that makes good sense. You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about living with PCOS. I want to take a moment to remind you that this show is brought to you by the generous support of our sponsors, including our wonderful gold sponsors, who are organizations and clinics who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. A couple of our great gold sponsors include Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility, with 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey. They maintain an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. We also have Fairfax Cryobank. Fairfax has been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years, and they are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Only 1 in 200 applicants make it through the screening process to become a donor. All right, another drug that we heard about, questions about, was Sprintec. How effective is Sprintec? How does it work? Anyway, somebody commented that they had a friend that took it for a year to regulate her cycles and then conceived naturally. So what is Sprintec?
So that is a combined oral contraceptive estrogen and progestin, like I talked about before. So it is it is one of many oral contraceptives that is out there. Many of them vary in the amount of estrogen they have, the amount of progesterone they have, but it is an oral contraceptive, and it's, when you look at the research, really the different oral contraceptives, as far as their efficacy, one has not shown necessarily to be better than another one as far as PCOS. And so what you're essentially doing is you're manipulating the hormonal profiles of the ovaries, so then you're kind of counteracting like what happens with PCOS. And so Sprintec is a common one that is used. There's the, you know, I don't want to go into specific types of oral contraceptives too much, but anybody that is considering oral contraceptives, there are certain oral contraceptives that may have less of an effect on kind of changing the male hormones. So specifically the progestin hormone, some of them tend to be less androgenic or less likely to increase and change the testosterone levels. So some of the patients, you could talk on it with your provider on an individual basis. Again, I don't want to go into specific details of the medications, but that there are kind of a couple medications that people consider doing if they have some of the hair growth issues and acne and those kind of things.
Right, the more male hormone. But here's what I don't really get. I get how the birth control pill will make you have a menstrual cycle, but you're not ovulating. That's the goal of the birth control pill, is you're not ovulating. So other than controlling the fact that, you know, the regularity of your cycle, how is it fundamentally changing anything? Because it's not helping you ovulate. So are you, in this case, when this discussion surrounding this particular oral contraceptive
was the fact
was
that they got pregnant.
That people,
yes.
Yeah, that they were more likely, I assume now, I didn't realize it was an oral contraceptive. I should have looked it up before the show. Obviously, they had to stop it. So you stop the oral contraception. Are you more likely then to ovulate because you have been on oral contraception for a year or whatever? Isn't that just kind of masking the lack of ovulation?
Well, as I mentioned previously, the way the PCOS works is it has to have very precise signals from the brain to the ovaries. The ovaries have to have very sequential changes in estrogen and then progesterone, you know, products. And what happens with the birth control pills is it sometimes does is tweaks the ovarian function enough to where when you go off of them, sometimes patients do ovulate, you know, but it's not an indicated treatment and an indicated way to go as far to get people pregnant. But their PCOS patients are notorious for ovulating at irregular intervals. So you could not ovulate for a whole year if somebody actually monitored and followed them. And then all of a sudden, they could have three cycles in a row where they ovulate. So it could just be, you know, a little change in the hormone levels when they first go off the birth control pills, that the PCOS has been, you know, kind of regulated, and then they're more likely to ovulate. But people that really have PCOS, they will ultimately become anovulatory and have anovulatory cycles. We just don't know exactly how much and when that happens in each individual.
Okay, and I want to spend some time talking about, we've talked about medical treatments, but there's always an interest in non-medical, natural treatments or supplements or alternative treatments for complementary treatments that are effective with treating any of the symptoms of PCOS, whether it be the infertility or whether it be the acne or the weight gain or the hair or the hair growth. So, or the insulin issues. So let's talk about, are there any, as somebody, I think it was Cindy said, what non-myth treatments, alternative treatments, would actually help with the symptoms? Because we all know that there are a lot of anecdotal, you know, gosh, you know, I ate grapefruit, you know, 5 grapefruit a day, and I got better. Therefore, it was the grapefruit that helped me, or whatever. For all I know, grapefruit might actually have some impact. But so let's talk some about these alternative treatments or natural treatments or dietary changes or stuff like that, with the exception of anything having to do with weight loss.
Yes, and this is a very, very hot topic. It is definitely not my specialty. There are there are quite a few groups and physicians that kind of specialize with PCOS, and they may be more helpful with this than myself. But my understanding is that when we talk about PCOS, we talk about the estrogen levels, and we talked about the environmental exposures to estrogen type, you know, agents, you know, foods, whatever. So when we talk about foods that are more estrogenic in nature, so sometimes if you have like beef products, dairy products, these animals are given estrogen, you know, and there's a potential concern that the amount of estrogen, you know, components in the meats and what we're eating in our daily diets may actually contribute or have some role with the PCOS. So by avoiding some of those things, there could potentially be a benefit. There's also evidence that, I know that there's also some talks about soy and some of those other estrogenic kind of components. And there's people that say that, like, tofu and soy foods and those kind of things may actually may help out with some of the hormonal imbalances. But the literature is not there to support these things. So, you know, there's not any hard, fast guidelines on dietary changes. Some other things, some non-traditional things are Eastern medicine therapies like acupuncture and things like that. They have potentially shown to be a benefit as far. Excuse me.
Sure.
Sorry.
I understand. I often have fought with a cough whenever I get a cold. That's the first thing that happens is I get a cough. It's always tough on the air when that happens. But
yeah, I woke up with something. But some, you know, so as far as like dietary changes, there's some evidence out there that may have a role. I don't have a steadfast plan and suggestions of what to do. So. Yeah.
All right. And one question I had, you were talking about the dairy products, and we actually got some questions on that. But you were saying that it was best to avoid the dairy products because of the potential for the added estrogen. But with soy products, which also have an estrogenic impact, it was thought that some people think that it's best to eat the soy products. Did I misunderstand you?
No, you understood me, and I was just illustrating the difference between, you know, natural estrogens in our foods versus what's been added, you know, for
gotcha.
The environment and everything. So I think that
it gets
back to eating natural foods. It gets back to the topic of, you know, what are we exposed to in our environment, our water supply, as potential roles in this condition, and as well as other conditions, a lot of other things that's being studied. So it's a concern.
All right, and I want to end on this one. We've talked about other health risks for women with polycystic ovary syndrome, and you know the particularly as it relates to the propensity to develop diabetes or insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But we did get a question, and I want to make sure we get it in, on are women who have PCOS at a higher cancer risk? I would assume that the cancer risk of concern would be ovarian cancer, but I may be wrong on that. Is there an associated increased cancer risk for people who have PCOS?
And I'm glad you brought this up, because the answer is the risk that we're talking about is ovarian cancer. I mean, sorry, I misspoke, is uterine cancer. So endometrial cancer, okay? And the whole reason why is because when women are not having regular periods, or they have gone 1, 2, 3-plus months without a period, what's happening is the uterus is being exposed to estrogen, and estrogen builds up the lining of the uterus. The more it builds up, and you don't have that period, it doesn't get rid of all those cells that are changing and being stimulated by the estrogen. It increases the risk of cellular changes that can ultimately lead to uterine cancer. So that is, I did not mention that earlier, but women that don't have regular periods, seeking a care at your provider and evaluating to see if you're at risk for that is definitely recommended, because it leads to endometrial hyperplasia, and it ultimately leads to cancer, and it's something that can be prevented by eliciting and helping the patient have periods, which we can do medically very easily.
And is that tested for with the pap smear?
No, it is not. The pap smear is for cervical changes. The way that this is done is it's done by the patient's history. How long have they gone without menstrual periods? Whether they're obese or not, their body's going to make more estrogen then, and that's going to predispose them to having changes, as well as through transvaginal ultrasound, where you can look and measure the thickness of the uterine lining. And if it's thick and the patient hasn't had a period, then sometimes it's indication to do a biopsy of the inside of the uterus to make sure that there's none of those early changes.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Alan Martinez, to talk about living with PCOS. Let me remind our audience that we primarily keep in touch with you folks via our weekly newsletter. We have two newsletters every week, one dealing with infertility, one dealing with adoption. So you get to choose, or you can choose both. So please sign up on the top right-hand side of any page of our website. If you want to participate in a discussion of the topics of this show, you can check out our blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog. Let's keep the ideas coming and the discussion going. I think that would be fun. For those of you who would like more information on Dr. Alan Martinez or on the Reproductive Science Center of New Jersey, you can go to their website, which is FertilityNJ.com, as in Fertility New Jersey. So FertilityNJ.com, and you can get information directly on Dr. Alan Martinez. Thank you guys for joining us today, and I will be back next week, and I look forward to talking with you then.
Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on HomeDepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $478 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas dryer extra. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.